Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank wants to know how you reward yourself, because they have cards that make every day more rewarding. Are you a points hoarder, cashback guru, low intro APR lover? With U.S. Bank, it's up to you, because they have the cards to fit your lifestyle. So earn more whether you're shopping at a gas station or grocery store, even while planning a staycation. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome in to the RotoWire NFL podcast. It is Thursday, January 28th of the year, 2021. I am your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. We do not have a real live NFL game this weekend, so most of the focus will be on the Senior Bowl, which is going on in Mobile, Alabama this week. Obviously a collection of some of the best senior talent around college football from this past year as they start to make their impressions on NFL front offices right there in front of them. So that's all ongoing. We are going to dive into that. But Mario, can I point out that today is the 20-year anniversary down in Raymond James Stadium, the same stadium where the Super Bowl is this year, where the Baltimore Ravens won Super Bowl 35 against the New York Giants. Everyone remembers that one.
I do remember that one. I didn't realize it had been that particular unit of time since then, but that was a good year of the NFL. Actually, it was kind of funny. I remember the Buccaneers had Super Bowl hype that year, and they were kind of doing this super team preseason coronation thing about, like, the NFC team's going to be Tampa Bay. Is it going to be the Titans or the Jags in the AFC? And then, the Ravens had the best defense ever or whatever. A lot of good aesthetic football from the Ravens that year. You got Jamal Lewis being an NFL blitz character. Yep. and looking just ridiculous. You got Mike McCrary putting up like 17 sacks from inside in the 3-4, the Bulware Lewis defense. Like that was some great football. Unlike this year the Chiefs are cool or whatever. But there was no representative of Satan in that particular Super Bowl, as much as people might think bad things about Ray Lewis or whatever.
No, that was, yeah, I mean, obviously everyone knows my background, so I love that team, you know, Chris McAllister, Jermaine Lewis, you know, so they had to have the Lewis. Nothing cooler to like a 7-year-old or 8-year-old or whatever I was than Sam a guy that's Adams, just running kicks Syracuse back all the time. Just,
yeah, the two, but also you got Tony Siragusa and Sam Adams.
I know, and I've been for our listeners, I've been running through The Sopranos lately, and I'm in a season where the Goose makes like several appearances, and I'm like, oh, Goose.
Yep.
Oh man, so yes, yeah, so a good little quick trip down memory lane there, but specifically remembering those 2000 Baltimore Ravens and that Super Bowl in Raymond James Stadium. We'll of course we'll touch on the Super Bowl in next week's edition of the podcast, but let's go ahead, let's dive in on the Senior Bowl for this week. Interesting collection of guys there. Obviously, like the Senior Bowl, it's full of guys that are talented, are most likely going to get drafted. Not all of them are going to be like your classic first round guys. You know, we have a lot of underclassmen, redshirt juniors or regular juniors that are obviously going to be in the mix in the first round as well. But Senior Bowl tends to turn out some guys, so we will we'll dive in here. I want to start out, I guess, with a guy that might be generating the most buzz this week. I don't know if my finger's on the right pulse there, but we've talked about him a little bit through our draft discussions already, but Dwayne Eskridge seems to be really, really turning a lot of heads in Mobile so far. Obviously, he's a guy that you wrote about in your initial receiver rankings. I wrote about him in my Senior Bowl viewing guide as well. I mean, he's a guy that, you know, allegedly runs in the low 4.3s, laser timed as of a couple of years ago. The rub is that he's undersized relatively, and he's overaged, I guess. So like, yeah, the production from especially this year, you kind of throw it out a little bit. I mean, it was impressive, but again, like we've established, it's something that like he had to do to even like make himself viable at this stage.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on him now that he's kind of come from being an under the radar guy that maybe a few of us knew about to someone who's, I think, more on the national radar now?
Yeah, he's kind of interesting. I think that it's so hard to fairly characterize what the sort of narrative around him is, because I feel like that's one of those things where I think most people are keeping a reasonable perspective on Eskridge. They're saying like, hey, nice showing from this guy. He's on the map in the middle rounds. And that's precisely how I look at it. Like I went in projecting him as kind of like a third, fourth, fifth rounder. And I think him playing well is kind of like one of those things that's necessary to just keep the 3 and 4 part of that range in play. Mm-hmm. Whereas if he weren't standing out, I would say, you know, he's older than these other guys. So if he's not standing out among them, that means that we should be lowering him. Because if he's not playing like he has the advantage that he does have, then something's wrong. So it's not to say that I know there are some people who are like, he's going to be 24 in you know, March, which means it's impossible for him to be good. And sure, I think that's a weird way of thinking about material reality. I don't believe that age it's actually nonsense. Like, there's no way someone can speak it out in literal logical form and still stand by the statement that like Dwayne Eskridge was good 2 years ago, and had he gone into the league 2 years ago, he would have stayed good, but having waited 2 years is now bad. It's like, he might be bad, but that's not the reason why he is. The reason you have to look at age for evaluating draft prospects is to provide the context around their production to determine how meaningful and valuable that production is. Mm-hmm. So in Eskridge's case, I'm not really looking at his 784 yards and 8 touchdowns on 52 targets, which is insane.
Yep.
Like, that's insanely productive in 6 games especially. But I'm not really looking at that and taking it away as anything meaningful. I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, you know, he dominated. We know that from the results here. But if he had done anything but dominate, that would be kind of a red flag. It would be like, if he had only I don't know, 450 yards and four touchdowns, and if he was only averaging like 10 yards a target, I would say, you know, he can go in the sixth or the seventh if he runs a 4.35. But now with him producing like that, it's not so much that he gets points for it; it's that he doesn't get stuck with the failing grade. You know, like he could have gotten the failing grade, he gets the passing grade, but he can't. He's not eligible for bonus points. Like he can't get higher points for doing this. He just gets allowed to progress to like the next phase of kind of like the breaking down of this class. It's like Eskridge is in play for the rounds 3 to 4, having played well in the Senior Bowl practices, and if he hadn't, he would not have been eligible for it.
That's a great way of framing it, and you know, it's so important to not count things twice when it comes to evaluating these guys. So I'd say, you know, don't want to speak for both of us necessarily, but I think we're both kind of in a similar spot where we view him as you know, someone who should go late day two, early day three, and you know, like you said, kind of just stamped that or has been stamping that throughout the course of this week. I mean, some like physical comparisons that you know, I think could resonate with some of our listeners. Maybe he could be like a KJ Hamler type, Richie James, although I imagine
his height weight is the exact same as Andy Isabella. So he's probably not as fast as Andy Isabella, though. Like he's probably like 4.37, 4.38, 4.35 maybe. Isabella was the 4.31, and I, by the way, still think Isabella is good. I'm blaming Cliff for one. So
Cliff is really dropped the ball. Idiot.
He's a moron. If I ever see him, he's going to get quite a spree of posts hurled at him.
Good.
To go back to Eskridge a little bit, I saw Todd McShay was saying, like, I wouldn't be surprised if Eskridge is in the first round.
Yeah, I saw
that.
That's
stupid. We don't need to do that, Todd.
Yeah, yeah, that's crazy. And if that's like a narrative that catches on, let someone else in your Dynasty League make that mistake.
Yeah, like Eskridge is interesting because he's a fast guy who's decently built for how fast he is, and he's produced at the college level. Like I was saying, like the 2020 production was insanely good, but not really valid because he was, you know, 23, almost 23 and a half, something like that. It doesn't matter. Like you have to dominate to be considered, but if you do dominate, you don't get anything. Like you don't get grandfathered into anything. It's just like you're just allowed to stay alive one more rung of this kind of ladder that we go up. But for Eskridge, the reason I don't write him off for his age is that he actually produced at a previous point in his career when he wasn't so old. Like,
yeah, 500 like, yards as a freshman.
Yeah, he was a 20 and a half for some reason. I don't know why he was so effing old even in his first years at Western Michigan, but and he was above baseline as their leading receiver in 2017. So you look at that snapshot, that one data point, and you can't attribute his production to his age. Like you can probably do that for 2020, but there's nothing about his age that explains why he was their best receiver and outproduced the team baseline back in 2017. So that indicates some level of skill that you can't attribute to his age. And if he is as toolsy as we think he is, and if he's running an actual 4.35, then it's like, you know, those are two pretty good grades as far as his production and then his athleticism. So really good Senior Bowl, that all that combined, so long as he runs the sub 4.4, does make him a viable, like, probably like right on the fringe of the top 100, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's the correct range for him at this stage. So it's trending in that direction. And again, if you're looking for like the, you know, the small speedy guy from this class, it's probably him, at least among the Senior Bowl guys. Let's get on over someone that you kind of like turned me back onto when you released your receiver rankings, and that's Nico Collins from Michigan. I think because, you know, what I have to do for our college football section, once he opted out for the season, he kind of just didn't exist to me for a couple of months because I had to, you know, like focus on the rest of, you know, what Michigan's fantasy outlook was doing. But, you know, he was a guy that was outproducing, or at least in line with guys like Donovan Peoples-Jones and Tariq Black, two guys that were kind of like the crown jewels of that recruiting class at Michigan a few years back. Like it, Nico Collins, like not a bad recruit by any means. Like he's still a 4-star. But yeah, Michigan was really rolling back then on the recruiting trail. But I mean, DPJ and Tariq Black were supposed to be like the guys, and Collins kind of ended up being, at least at Michigan, as good or better than them.
Yeah, and I think in Peoples-Jones's case, especially seeing how he did as a rookie, we can look at that Michigan offense and the way that it was constructed, the way they ran their system there, and I think we can we don't want to assume that the system is to blame for Collins and DPJ failing to hit the conventional production marks that we like to see from top prospects. But Peoples-Jones at least makes it plausible. The way that he played as a rookie with the Browns makes it plausible in hindsight, at least, that they would have produced much better had they had a different quarterback or different coaching.
I just can't believe how bad of a fit Shea Patterson ended up being at Michigan.
Yeah, man, I don't know why.
They took elements out of his game and just like tried to make him this like pro style drop back passer when he was at Ole Miss with AJ Brown and DK Metcalf, like running around, he kind of looked like Johnny Manziel, and they like removed that from him. And yeah, the whole offense just kind of got clunkier. And to your point, like, yeah, I didn't think a whole lot of Peoples-Jones going into the draft last year because those production metrics were so far below what, you know, you would normally expect from a draft eligible type of guy.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like Peoples-Jones, first of all, he might not be great or anything in the NFL, but if he's even serviceable as a guy who can give you like 700-750 snaps, then Collins almost has to be the same thing. Like he produced more volume and but with more efficiency at Michigan than Peoples-Jones. Granted, it was a different role. I don't remember how much Peoples-Jones played at the same time as Ronnie Bell or whatever, but Nico played that outside sideline only kind of role where he's basically running like post routes and fly routes and not much in between, not much over the middle of the field. So with Collins, you might say like, oh, I don't know if you can use him in the slot. I don't know if he has the versatility we want. I don't know if he can run enough kinds of different routes. Those are possible limitations with Collins that might have informed his low share of the offense, like right around 17%, if I remember right, of their receiving yardage share. And it's also possible that it was more to do with Patterson and the offensive, just the people in charge, that Collins didn't get a bigger share because that passing game was not very good. And Collins was super efficient, like way above the baseline, doing just automatic production per usage unit. And yet they didn't raise his usage. So you have to guess at that point, like, did they not raise his usage because, you know, they didn't think of it or they couldn't figure it out or something? In any case, that wasn't Collins' fault. Or is it, you know, due to Collins that they couldn't get him going more? Like, maybe he's only situationally good. Maybe he's good on these plays but can't do anything on any plays of any other type. Like, that's a possibility, but that was something you would have had to have figured about Donovan Peoples-Jones as well, and it turned out to not be the case. It just turned out like they were just using him wrong. Like they could have used him a better way and they didn't. So for me, I'm going to be a little bit optimistic about Collins, if only because Peoples-Jones was so good as a rookie and because Nico Collins outproduced him basically at Michigan, albeit in a slightly different receiver position, and like again playing more outside and more downfield than Peoples-Jones, who might have got some slot work or something like that, which might not have suited him as well. But the possibility of Collins just being like a total dud strikes me as pretty low. And in the meantime, pending his workout numbers and pending kind of how the NFL receives him, how they end up ranking him as scouts and front office people, there's quite a bit of upside possible. Like if he had his usage increased at Michigan, there's no guarantee that the efficiency would have fallen off. And if he had more volume, we wouldn't be wondering at all what he is. We would just be like, oh yeah, he's the 6'4", 215 guy who put up the big numbers at Michigan. As it is, we know that he put up numbers insofar as he was allowed to play, basically, but they didn't let him get the volume for whatever reason. And the answer to why kind of will determine, I think, how good he turns out to be in the NFL.
Interesting. Now, that's a really good way of putting that. I'm definitely more inclined to place the blame at Michigan's feet than Collins himself.
He could be like a Galladay type best case, or not even like best case scenario. It's like best case scenario, he could just be really good.
Yeah.
We just don't know how specifically fast, how specifically how high jumping he is. And we don't know specifically if he can't do the things Michigan didn't ask him to, or if they just didn't ask him to because they were foolish.
Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, like they had a couple of talented guys in those other roles. So if they had like those roles that were that strictly defined, you know, the counter to what Alabama would do last year, where like Judy, Ruggs and Devontae Smith would literally like play rock, paper, scissors to figure out who's going to run which route, but like going into a play, totally different situation at Michigan. The comp that I kind of landed on for Collins was like, if Tim Patrick was good right away Tim Patrick, yeah, without like having the 3-year waiting room practice squad hubbub before like actually getting a role.
Yeah, I think Collins might be a little bit heavier. I can't remember what Patrick weighed coming out of Utah. And if I remember right, Patrick was a little bit old for his recruiting class. I don't know what Collins' date of birth is. If you look it up, you get this stupid like YouTube anime video kid or
waifu
something.
Collins.
Yeah, I don't. It's like I'm trying to find Nico Collins, the wide receiver's date of birth, and it's like this TikTok influencer was born on. It's like, grr. So we don't know how old he. If Nico Collins is like 23 right now, then he's probably not any good in the NFL. He's probably like a Marcel Aitman or something. But if it turns out that Nico Collins is like 21 right now, then it's like, you know, he put up those numbers that are good. And if he put them up with an age disadvantage, then it's that much more reason to think that he's got skill that most players don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think you have that right. Let's move on over. Another guy that I thought kind of stood out from your initial ranks and piqued my interest. That's Amari Rodgers out of Clemson.
Yeah.
So he's someone who has been really having a strong week thus far from pretty much all indications. And he's one of those guys that had a really promising weigh in as well. I think like he's like 5'10", 210 or something in that range.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's right in line with what he was listed at Clemson. And it's, you know, that really nice combo of size and density with some speed and some, you know, run after the catch ability baked on top of it. So, I mean, that's not quite, it's almost like a miniature frame of like an AJ Brown or something in terms of like what that density looks like. It Brown, obviously taller and heavier, but, you know, similar compact type of style. Again, not drawing a direct comparison, but like a smaller version of him potentially. He's been apparently, you know, from what I've seen on from the banter on Twitter and from watching the practices a little bit on TV, it looks like he's really, really making a name for himself this week.
Yeah, Rodgers, I think, might be very good. Like, I don't want to kind of invite unfair expectations for him. It's very weird to me actually how quiet his brand is. It's like, I don't know if it's just kind of like Clemson burnout, like people looking at, you know, T. Higgins, Justin Ross, and maybe they look at Rodgers, and because he's the slot guy, maybe they think, oh, this is just the Artavis Scott of this era. We already saw the Mike Williams go into the league, and this is just the Artavis Scott. This is not Artavis Scott. I don't know what Amari Rodgers really is exactly, because it's hard for me to remember. Like, I'm trying to think back, like, who is a 5'9½, 211-pound receiver of any kind, let alone one that produced the way that Rodgers did at Clemson and might have the athletic characteristics that Rodgers does, which, like, Rodgers looks fast on tape and he's a 5-star recruit. It would be pretty surprising if he tested poorly, even at this very dense weight. Like, 5'9½, you're usually talking like, you know, Dwayne Eskridge. You're usually talking like 188, 192. To be 211 or 210 or whatever Rodgers is, and it's all good weight. You know, like, it's not like he showed up out of shape. It's all good weight. And that's a running back frame. Like, that's a distinctly running back like frame to be 5'9½, over 210. And yet he's a battle tested receiver from a variety of functions. I think, like, earlier, especially in his career, it was like all slot stuff, all underneath that role. that, you know, Hunter Renfrow and Adam Humphries played, which he played much better than either of them, yep, at a much younger age than either of them. And it's like he produced above the baseline set that, you know, T. Higgins and Justin Ross set, which was a very high baseline. And when I call it, when I'm saying baseline production, I'm referring to the team's overall passing production. His catch rate and his yards per target numbers cumulatively are like above whatever that settled point is. Like if Trevor, if Lawrence was averaging 8.5 yards per attempt and completed 67% of his passes, then I'm calling like a 10-point deficit in the catch rate something that can be offset by a full yard surplus for the yards per target. And yet, like, Rodgers doesn't need like an offset from one thing being below the baseline and the other, you know, making up the difference. It's like his catch rate's above the team baseline. His yards per target is a little bit above the team baseline, which is to say, like, Trevor Lawrence's attempts would go for as much yardage with Rodgers as the overall team alternative, the cumulative team alternative, but he would also catch those targets at like 12 points higher catch rate. So you can, it's possible for a player to do that stuff while playing next to these other very good players and still not be good themselves. It just seems borderline impossible. Like, it seems exceedingly unlikely. So those reasons alone were enough for me to buy into Rodgers just going into the Senior Bowl. Mm-hmm. And if he turns out to be a good athletic tester at the combine, I really don't see why he shouldn't be a first round pick. Like what Todd McShay said about Eskridge, he should have said about Amari Rodgers.
There you go. There you have it. So yeah, Rodgers definitely trending upwards, doing really well. His counterpart, Cornell Powell, I don't think he's done or has made quite as many waves this week. I think he's more like that fourth, fifth, maybe sixth round type of guy. Again, someone that I totally wrote off going into this year, just because it's like, well, if you do absolutely nothing the first 3 years of your career, most of the time, like, you know, how good can you really be? But he was awesome this year, and you know, you can take some of the blame off of the lack of production the first couple of years when there are guys like Mike Williams or T. Higgins or Justin Ross, you know, absorbing such a heavy amount of the targets, like, what, you know, and Amari Rodgers, of course. So, you know, like, where was the room for a guy like Cornell Powell, who was playing outside, to get the reps, get the targets, that sort of thing. So I'm still, you know, intrigued by Powell, but yeah, I mean, he's definitely the lesser, or like the lower ranked by a considerable gulf between these two Clemson receivers.
Yeah, I honestly got to look more at that guy because I kind of wrote him off, but he's got good numbers this year, so I'll have to take a look. But I do expect he has more of like a Jerron Brown kind of NFL career than whatever good Clemson receiver we're thinking of.
Okay, all right, that's fair. That's definitely fair. But he at least played himself onto the NFL radar, yeah, this year, whereas coming into the year, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Let's talk a couple running backs. We'll just kind of bounce around. We don't need to like keep it in one position group. A guy with maybe the most interesting weigh in, and I'm really interested to hear what your reaction there was. Ramondre Stevenson from Oklahoma, yeah, someone who, when we talked about him last, I forget if we even did on the podcast itself, but someone who was listed at like 240 some odd pounds.
He was listed at the AJ Dillon highway.
Yes, exactly. And you know, shows up to Mobile Monday, weighs in 5'11", 227. So now he's a much more conventional running back. And there's, I laid this case out in the article, but you know, he doesn't have a ton of carries to his name even still. I mean, that 165 carries in his career, but he averaged 7.2 yards per carry. Again, the 165 carries, that's not a lot. Everyone knows that. But, you know, similar to market share for these, you know, star-studded receiver groups, Oklahoma had a damn backfield, man. Like, you know, Kennedy Brooks was amazing, didn't play this year, but he was ridiculous in 2019. Trey Sermon eating up a good bit of the work back in like 2018. TJ Pledger, a really talented player. Jalen Hurts and Kyler Murray, of course, you know, taking up a lot of carries from their quarterback position as well. So that it's not like there was a ton of carries available for any one guy. And Stevenson also was suspended late last season through the first five games of this year. So that also shrunk his volume. But once he got eligible, he crushed it. I think he scored three touchdowns in his first game back this year and never really looked back as that top guy for Oklahoma. Again, while they also had talented running backs that were doing well. I mean, TJ Pledger and McGowan, I think his name is. Escaping me a little bit. But yeah, anyway, Stevenson just was really productive and explosive. And now that he has like that more conventional, like 5'11", 227, not necessarily conventional, but you know, something that we've seen before, something that we can wrap our minds around. I'm really interested in him now.
Yeah, especially thanks to Derrick Henry and A.J. Dillon, there is a recent precedent of a player like Stevenson being both valued and valuable in the NFL. So that's pretty interesting, and I don't know what to make of his weigh-in exactly, because he didn't look, you know, overweight or anything when he was on the field for Oklahoma, and he was listed at 246. So that's a pretty substantial weight change. 19 pounds is a lot for any frame, really. So that's a big transformation, to the point that he might look fundamentally different. I can't remember anybody's weight changing that much from, you know, listed height, weight, and what they might have plausibly had on the field in college to weighing in at something so low as that. So he looked pretty fast at if he was at 245 or whatever, he looked pretty fast playing at that weight, and the production is great, not good. That includes pass catching, by the way. Like, part of what's interesting about him is that this year he had a shortened season. Of course, there was only six games, but in all but one of them, the Florida game, he was busy as a pass catcher, or at least the four games in between. Is caught four passes on four targets for 60 yards against Kansas, three catches for 54 yards on four targets against Oklahoma State, five catches for 48 yards on seven targets against Baylor, four catches for 36 yards on five targets against Iowa State. And the year before, in 2019, he caught all 10 of his targets for 87 yards. So he's caught 28 of 35 targets for 298 yards, which is very good. And so if he's this big guy who is pretty fast and cannot just stay on the field for passing down work, but thrive catching passes in those snaps, I'm having trouble ruling out high upside scenarios here. Like, I know there's some sort of risk here in the meantime, insofar as like we don't have any reason to think he'll be drafted high, and so we don't know or have any reason to believe that the NFL will give him a serious chance. But if they do, or if he somehow stumbles into opportunity, all the results to this point, all the conventional metrics to this point are saying bye. So granted, he was suspended for, I don't know if they thought it was like a failed drug test or whatever this year.
Yeah, there was like a three or four OU guys that they got slapped with that before the playoff game last year.
Yeah, and that's a senior player who, by all accounts, is very good. Being suspended for that many games, that's not something those schools give up easily, you know? So there's probably some amount of character red flags that he'll get grilled for. But if the NFL doesn't hold it against him, I don't think this is a guy who will fail when they put him on the field. Now, as far as the A.J. Dillon, Derrick Henry comparison goes, that's gone at this weight. And at this new weight, I don't know what he is exactly. It's like you change it from more like A.J. Dillon and Derrick Henry to guys like Royce Freeman, who even still is like 8 pounds heavier. I don't really know what the 228 example is, but
I had a Isaiah Crowell.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a little bit bigger and faster than that. But what I was thinking was, I saw some people comparing him to Eddie Lacy, which was actually wrong in my opinion, because Eddie Lacy pretty clearly gained a lot of bad weight once he got to the NFL. He did not look overweight at all at Alabama.
Nope.
He was like a 215-pound guy at Alabama, and he was really damn good, yep, too. But Stevenson being more like 228, that almost is like, man, I guess if he lost that much weight, maybe he is kind of getting close to Alabama Eddie Lacy. And I consider Alabama Eddie Lacy a very good thing. So we'll see. I'm interested to see how it turns out. But there's also a chance that Stevenson is a guy who runs like, I don't know, let's say a 4.55, a 4.58 at 246. If at 227 he's running something more like a 4.48, that puts him in a pretty unique company as far as density and size adjusted as athleticism goes. And if he can catch passes with a frame like that, I mean, you can't rank a guy like Stevenson alongside players like ETN and Najee Harris, but I think he does have similar upside as both of them. It's just the floor, we have no idea where it is.
Yeah, and again, you know, this is a class where once you get outside the top two, it can be really, really fluid with how you want to rank them. And you know,
there's no running back depth in this draft. I think it's this weird thing that might happen where even though the class is the worst we've seen in years, we might see running backs go surprisingly high just because there is – like in all those other cases where running back slipped, you did that under the reasoning of like, well, we can get one later. You can't get one later here. Like if you draft anybody who is plausibly projected to go after the first four rounds, I don't think is worth drafting in this class. And some of those guys who are worth drafting in that category are not full-time candidates. Like they're role players. So particularly with the workhorse and three down upside and the big play upside, Stevenson is the only guy I can really think of who can compete with those, in my opinion anyway. Like even guys like Javonte Williams with North Carolina, like as good as him and like Jamar Jefferson both could be, like Stevenson really stands out for the upside in a class where the depth is the lowest it's been in years.
That, yeah, I love how you put that. That's pretty spot on. Yeah, the upside is definitely there. Correction on my part. Did not mean to invoke 2018 Oklahoma. Stevenson was a JUCO transfer, got there in 2019. That is reflected in the article. I just kind of forgot it on the fly there when we were talking about him. So do not lump him in with like the Kyler Murray conversation. But bottom line there, there's a lot to like when it comes to Stevenson. I think he exits this week or will exit this week as one of the biggest risers. And like you said, in the broader context of this running back class, he might have really, really done a lot for himself this week where you know, the things can kind of fall off a cliff once you reach a certain threshold among those guys. One of those guys who I think might be a trap, and he might not even stick at running back, but you had the sniff out for him in your article where you ranked him, and I was a little surprised at first because I thought in my mind the production was better than it really was, but it was just really good for fantasy. And that's Demetric Felton of UCLA. So, I mean, he was running behind Josh Kelly in 2019. It's a funky system that they have at UCLA under Chip Kelly. So he caught a ton of passes, you know, 55 catches on 73 targets for 594. But, you know, a lot of that is kind of like in the slot type of deal. And you know, he was only running it on occasion back then. He had 86 carries in 2019, and he wasn't particularly effective with them. A lot more effective in a more conventional role this year. So, I mean, he did prove that he has pass catching ability. And yeah, kind of my takeaway is that, and I know that he's done some reps at receiver this week. I think that might be his path. I don't think his path is at running back.
Yeah, I was probably too harsh toward Felton. Like, I still have no interest in having him on a football team. Like, if I was running a team, this player has no role on my team. I don't think that there's a healthy offense that you can run where he's getting usage in it. I don't believe it's the case. But there are players who I would say that about who do play in the NFL. Nyheim Hines is one of them. So that's one guy that gets compared to Felton. And I, you know, it's like we saw Theo Riddick get good run in the NFL, even though he sucked. There's a chance that Felton will convince some team, a dumb team, I will tell you ahead of time, but some team might say like, oh, we can use this guy. Some stupid coach might look at him and go like, ooh, I know what my galaxy brain playbook with this guy is going to be something, a real treat. And every time that happens, I think you get results more like Tyler Irvin in Green Bay this year. It's like coaches are great at this. Like, and most coaches in the NFL are great at looking at a player who is novel or otherwise entertaining or something like that, and thinking like, oh, I got to make this guy happen, or like I can make this guy happen, and I'm clever. I'm the one clever enough to really cut this guy loose. And it usually turns out it's like, no, he's novel because he doesn't look like anything you've seen that has succeeded in the past. And like, that's why you haven't seen it happen. It's not because he's this new thing. It's because past cases of this have failed already and you just forgot. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty clearly what's going on with Felton here. Like, I will say he does have legitimate pass catching ability. And I, for that reason, I definitely agree with you when you say, like, he's just a receiver, because here's the deal with Felton. And I can see, like, the reasoning that attracts people to him as a running back. And that this could very well include an offensive coordinator, some coach of or GM of significant influence. I don't really know. But they look at him and they think, like, oh, if I put him in the backfield, then the defense will have to match him up against the linebacker. And I know that, like, Alvin Kamara does stuff like that for the Saints, and I bet I can do that with this guy. And I'll motion him outside, and he runs routes like a receiver when he's outside, and who can cover him then? And it's like, okay, well, you should, instead of just asking yourself these rhetorical questions, you should, you know, at the very least ask someone who knows how to call a defense what they would do, or just look at the way NFL defenses handle things in these situations, because you don't put a linebacker on him unless you choose to, you know? Like, I'm not watching Demetric Felton go into the huddle and then think, like, oh, man, we got to stop the run now. Get Reggie Ragland out there. And then, you know, they match up Ragland on Felton and they motion him out wide. And I'm like, no, when he goes and catches the long pass. That's just not happening, because when I see him go into the huddle, I'm not putting Reggie Ragland out there. I'm putting someone like Will Redmond or some backup safety. It doesn't really matter, because whoever it is, as long as they're a defensive back, they can cover him, and that moving him out wide doesn't get the mismatch. And the reason you don't get that mismatch is because he's not good enough as a runner to force that threat. If he's good enough as a runner, maybe we're talking about a linebacker instead. Maybe I'm putting my 230-pound relatively quick linebacker on him instead, because I still respect him enough as a runner that I don't want to have a safety matched up against him in the ground game. But I do, because it's not going to hurt me to defend the run. If the run threat is Felton, my safety can deal with it. Any vaguely league average safety can deal with that threat. And then once you lose that threat, you're only really bluffing it from that point. And I'll call your bluff. I'll just ignore it. I don't care. Put him out there. And let him run routes against my fifth corner. He won't get open. And so that's the way it goes in practice with players like him and Tyler Irvin. People like to look at guys like that who don't fit. They look at the tweeners and they go, like, oh, he's good at both things. No, he's good at neither of them. And you're trying to justify him as a whole by saying he's contributing in both to a sum that's useful. It's not. And in practice, you got to get the matchup for him to actually, you know, threaten the defense credibly. And he can't credibly threaten the defense as a runner. He could threaten it as a receiver, though. In the case of a linebacker covering him, yes, Felton will win that rep. And as Hines showed with the Colts this year, you can get him matched up against a linebacker occasionally. And if a team like the Titans in that one game don't adjust, you can keep going to that play. And yeah, Felton's good enough as a receiver to get open against a linebacker. That's something I don't debate at all.
Sure.
But as far as getting that matchup, that's a hasty presumption, because you have to respect the runner as a runner to put a linebacker out there in response to him going into the huddle. And I don't see anything for Felton as a running back. It's totally a theoretic thing where people are thinking at the novelty of a running back catching that many passes is threatening to a defense, when it's more like you're probably just spinning your tires and not going anywhere.
Right. I mean, it's a similarity, if you follow college football, to like the pass catching running backs in like an air raid offense, where it's effectively like a extension of the run game. And like, you're doing like end up doing like six and a half, seven yards per.
Yeah, it's like DeAnthony Thomas, Chris Rainey stuff, except he's slower than both of them and didn't produce as well as either.
And he's overage too. I think his recruiting class was like 2016.
Right. So I got to give him this credit, and I missed this initially. I probably should rank him more like the running back 15 in this class rather than 22 or whatever I did. He did have good receiving production in 2019.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's only as a possession capacity. Like, he has a high catch rate above the team baseline. There's not much there in the way of big plays, of like truly plays that are like harmful to the defense. It seems like a lot of checkdowns, a lot of taking what's there kind of stuff, which he did. And there's a function for that. You can, you know, not everybody takes what's there. And he at least did that much. But he was also 21 at the time. And I think it's like when you're 21 and a half, that's the age as a prospect where I need you to go well above the baseline before I'm going to, especially when you talk about UCLA, like there's no good pass catchers there, right? Like there's nobody,
no,
there's no one like setting
Kyle
the baseline.
Phillips. I don't think so.
Yeah. It's like, there's nobody raising the baseline in such a way that makes it, that builds in the excuse if he fails to go above it. It's like, you're competing against losers right now. You should be way better than them. You shouldn't just be slightly better than them, especially now that you're, going into your fourth year sort of age. Like a senior should make the underclassmen on the team, and especially the lesser talented underclassmen, look completely inferior. And I didn't really see that. It was just kind of like he was the best option they had hanging around kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was yeah, again, like, 10 yards per catch, basically, last year with all of that with all those targets. So, like you said, a good catch rate, but, yeah, not really doing anything explosive, and you should be. I put a little GIF in the article on one of his kick run backs that, you know, showed some pretty, like, fun short area make you miss type of stuff. But, you know, kickoffs. They're not the same as a conventional offensive play. It's just kind of fun to watch, but
people are putting these clips of him running routes, and being like, look at him getting open. It's like, aren't you people sick of doing this every year? Like, don't you remember the Braxton Miller and whatever else we've gone through?
Oh,
like, these are not drills where the corners can win. There's no, like, playing with, okay, I don't want to talk about, like, endless football theory or something, but, like, those drills don't carry anything analogous to the conditions of actual plays. They're more just, like, you run these plays to set a practice structure up and, like, get guys kind of, you know, in football motion before you do live drills and things like that. No one's watching this and thinking like, oh wow, because he got away from this.
Yeah. The release heads out there on Twitter
by themselves. Like normally in a defense, you defend a certain leverage and you know that other defenders are going to carry certain parts of the field. Even in man coverage, you still tend to have slight leans. With this, it's just like the receiver can run wherever he wants and there's no help anywhere and there's no pass rush and it's just not meaningful. And yet you have people hyping him with these items. And if these things inform his price, then his price is wrong. Like you should not invest in something where the value presupposes meaning in these clips. They aren't meaningful. They don't, like, he might be good, but it doesn't have anything to do with those clips.
No, exactly. So yeah, don't fall for whatever. Look at him just shaking dudes like a salt shaker. I think I saw one of those tweets out there last night. I was like, okay, I'm going to bed.
That Austin Gale guy is like, this is big for him to get wide receiver reps. He's listed at wide receiver.
Yeah.
He's listed at wide receiver on the Senior Bowl roster. That's because he played wide receiver up until last year. It's like, what are we talking about? I know that's like some people just want to have fun looking at clips and being like, ooh, this guy is cool or whatever, but like, this is yellow journalism. Come on. The guy is a receiver. It's not impressive that he's lining up at receiver. This is ridiculous. You can find any meaning you want in anything if you believe that.
See, exactly. So, yeah, don't take the bait as far as that is concerned. Let's move on. Do you want to unpack some Larry Roundtree?
Sure. I mean, you know a lot more about him than me. I only watched a little bit, and I couldn't – you know, he's one of those guys who – looks fine. Like you don't watch him and think like, ah, this guy sucks. But you don't really see anything of like star indication. And when you look at his numbers, they're pretty good, but they don't stand out from even somebody like Demarre Crockett, who I still, to be honest, don't really understand why he was so bad. But
these Missouri dudes, they like lure us in. I mean, we were the original Emmanuel Hall guys.
Okay, I think his is a weird like durability sort of related thing. I don't know. But yeah, it's like they did have Henry Josie and at running back. And I feel like there was another guy too. But in any case, Crockett had like a really big freshman year, which was the weird thing with him. And then he kind of got worse every year. Like, I guess he was almost like Missouri Cadre Allison or whatever. Mm. And then Roundtree is this guy who he wasn't exactly better than Crockett, but sometimes you have cases where the player who wasn't as good in college is still the better pro player. And things like athletic testing will help us kind of narrow the possibilities for Roundtree. But in the meantime, he's a guy who, I don't know. It's he's one of those guys who I don't see any reason to invest in, really, like in Dynasty, mostly. Because anyway, if you're in a deep format, then sure. It's like if you go, whatever, five rookie rounds, then you should probably have him on somebody's roster. But in the meantime, he's more just in that category for me where he, I don't know, probably like that Wayne Gallman kind of thing where it's like, if he ends up on the field, sure, he could probably do something. You know, he can find a way to stay on the field in third down situations. He can do this and that at an adequate level, but he won't be good enough, or at least in the likely outcome, he won't be good enough to hold on to it in the long term. It's like he needs to stumble into opportunity. But if Roundtree surprises me and goes in like the third or fourth round, then that would be a substantial indication that a team is going to give him a chance. And in the meantime, I don't see anything about him that makes me think he'll fail if he does get that chance.
Okay. I just feel like if he's drafted in the first four rounds, like he will have done something athletically that I don't think that there are particularly strong indicators that he will. I think that you can look at him and I just like, I love the overall consistent production from him, and the frame is good too, you know, 5'10", 216, but just, I think there's just a certain lack of explosiveness that I think could sink him completely. Like one, you know, historical comparison that I came to was like Elijah Holyfield, where like he was a productive runner, especially his last year at Georgia. And then gets to the combine and just totally blows it. And like, I have similar fears for Roundtree because, over his last 2 years, he had just like 12 runs of 20 or more yards. And that's like 400 carries worth of sample. That's concerning to me.
I'll just say, like, I am not getting my hopes up about Roundtree, but there are certain guys that I look at and I'm like, he can't play. Mm. And I don't say that about Roundtree. I'm not getting excited or hopeful either. I'm just kind of like, this is a guy, he could hang around, you know? But in the meantime, yeah, I guess I'm trying to think of like what I would compare him to. Sorry, I can't think of anything good, but it's. I just think if he has
David Montgomery without the hype.
Oh no! I mean, I think David Montgomery was definitely a better player, and you know that sounds. I'm sure that sounds strange, like, but you hated him. Like, I think I hated
the discourse.
I didn't hate Montgomery. I just hated the people who kept bleeding all day about how he's the number one running back and Hakeem Butler's the number one receiver, even though Iowa State scored like 24 points per game in the Big 12. But yeah, he's just a guy.
Yeah,
you know, like, I can see him being useful in fantasy just because if he gets on the field, he probably won't embarrass himself. Maybe like Jeff Wilson or something like that kind of possibility. Okay. It's like a long shot, but he's one of the better long shots as far as they go.
Okay, yeah, but he probably falls in that camp. You know, we were talking about earlier, like the cliff in this running back class, where you know, what once you get past a certain point, it's like these guys probably just like aren't totally worth it. But yeah, he probably falls in that class. But like you said, if he gets the opportunity, maybe he makes good on it as well. So that's kind of the Larry Roundtree.
He's no Rob Kelly or something like that. Like, he's better than that.
Okay. All right. I can live with that. Have you looked at any of the tight ends other than obviously like Kyle Pitts, but he's not even there?
Not a whole lot, to be honest. I got to figure out like Trey McKitty is kind of interesting.
Yes. Yes. A Georgia Bulldog by way of Florida State.
Right. Yeah. So do you want to, you almost certainly know a lot more about him than me. Do you have any particular view on him?
You know, like, I think that this year didn't work out as well as Georgia fans were hoping for him. And I think part of that also had to do with the fact that, you know, that the passing game just didn't work until JT Daniels took over. So that was basically like the last four games of the season. They had Stetson Bennett trying to play quarterback, and that obviously wasn't working. So McKitty, you know, he was like fifth on the team in target share, just an average of 7% of the targets when he was out there, kind of dealt with some bumps and bruises along the way this season. And there was also this freshman tight end, Darnell Washington, who is literally LeBron James's size, or maybe a little bit bigger. Ridiculous. We'll, of course, talk about him a couple years down the road. But, yeah, I mean, McKitty, he was productive every time that they used him. It's just they barely used him at all. So, I mean, I think there's probably a little bit more useful sample to be taken from his Florida State days. But, I mean, he was good in his Florida State days, I thought, especially his junior season, freshman year, you know, catching like only about half of his passes. But I think you also have to realize how bad Florida State's entire offense was in 2018. Yeah. I mean, it was bad in 2019 as well, don't get me wrong, but I mean, McKitty definitely showed some improvement in 19 compared to 18 when he was just a sophomore. So there's stuff to like about him. Apparently he had this very fancy one-handed grab during practice. So I think that he's someone that I think there's a lot of room for upward mobility among these tight ends at the Senior Bowl, because I think outside of Kyle Pitts, it's not an awesome class, or at least it's not like full of name brand guys. So,
is the biggest name at, sorry, is the biggest Senior Bowl tight end name then, Kenny Yeboah?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. So he's one that I have trouble figuring out too, because his Temple production was not very interesting exactly. But then this year his production was very interesting.
Yeah.
And I can't tell if it's just like, oh, that's, I can't tell if it was because it's just he's basically playing wide receiver now, and it's, you know, he won't get the chance to do these things in the NFL. But it's not that often that you see someone produce like that at tight end.
And he like eviscerated Alabama.
Right. That's pretty interesting. And I don't know. It's like you look at him and he's not one of these ridiculous cases where it's, you know, this is clearly just a wide receiver playing tight end. Like, he's not like 6'4", 215. He's not doing a Dan Arnold or something like that. You know, like, he's a real tight end sort of build. So he doesn't need to be wide receiver good as a receiver to get on the field. And if he has he's probably not a good blocker or whatever. He's probably not a guy you're trying to get in line exactly. But if you're not a liability in that respect, it's again just kind of like a way that you can get on the field, which is, especially for these mid-late round guys, that's crucial. It's like you want a guy to have like swing backup functions so that if an injury happens at one of two positions, they can get on the field at either of them, you know?
Yeah, and he's got like frame stuff to where like you can coach him up as a blocker a bit, you know, like he's got like an 80 inch wingspan or something like that. So
yeah, I mean, it seems like he's pretty decently sized for tight end. So I haven't done a study of him exactly, but the numbers are pretty interesting. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what these guys like Freiermuth amount to and whoever else is like a high tight end pick, but isn't present because of their underclass status. But this seems like a pretty weak class after Pitts, who's like barely a tight end.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like Brevin Jordan. I know he had some productive days at Miami, but that's a guy who's schematically limited. Excuse me. Sorry. He's like more of like a sort of H-back, whatever, wide receiver kind of build. So I'm not really seeing a lot to get excited about with the tight ends, but as far as the options go, Yeboah definitely stands out thanks to his production.
I think so too. One other guy, I think that there's like it's more likely that he doesn't end up doing anything in the NFL than him being someone that's on the fantasy radar, but I thought that Tony Poljan's college career was at least interesting enough to talk about.
I'm pretty ignorant about him. What is his deal?
So he was a quarterback at Central Michigan for, I believe, his first two seasons there. Switched to tight end when Jim McElwain got there to be the new head coach in 2019, and did well. You know, he caught like 33 passes, almost 500 yards, four touchdowns. He's 6'7", 265, I think, is the craziest part. So, I mean, there aren't a lot of cases, and he doesn't have that Jimmy Graham, you know, like athleticism to him. So, I mean, he could just be like this oversized, lanky, like too lanky for his own good type of guy. And you could definitely see that with some of the blocking tape from his time at Virginia. He transferred to Virginia this past year, and he was good. I mean, on a per target basis, not crazy, but I don't think that offense is just year over year. It's very funky. Like it's hard to like make the right, conclusions from a lot of that offense. It's very, very weird, but Bulgin still led the team in touchdowns. He had like 6 receiving touchdowns this year. So that was obviously good as well. I think that he's an interesting dude. I mean, he's so big, and he's had, you know, a career where he started out at quarterback. So he's still probably learning the ropes and coming into things as a tight end himself.
Yeah, this is honestly, this is the first I've been looking at him, and it is pretty interesting. I can't remember what is it? It's like AJ Derby or whoever that Arkansas guy was.
Oh, shoot.
Was a quarterback at Iowa, and then but he didn't produce this well when he got to Arkansas, and he wasn't much of an athlete. I don't know what, like, being 6'7", 6'6", 265 with this background is especially the weird part, because if I remember right, Derby was more like your standard 6'4", 245 or whatever, whatever a relatively big quarterback constitutes. It was not anywhere near this big. And yet you look at his quarterback years, it's like he's got some rushing production that you don't really see with pocket. It's like you don't really average 6 yards a carry when you adjust for the sacks, unless you can run a little bit. And then this year, or first of all, in 2019, those are just really good numbers.
Yeah.
33 of 49 for 496. That's just very good by any standard. And then this year, it's a little less efficient, only 411 yards on 59 targets. But it's one of those things to me that he's getting this target volume is kind of the more significant detail, because he basically looks like he's the best pass catching option on the team. They weren't getting like
other than my dude Lavelle Davis.
Right, yeah, it's just like this a tight end, especially a tight end of his build, getting that many targets, it's not something that really happens at all. So it could be happening here for very weird, novel, you know, basically structural deficiencies with the Virginia offense. But I feel like it's more likely, at least given his prior production, that it's like they were forced to keep him in the game plan as a pass catcher. And that's a weird thing categorically for a 6'6", 265 guy. Like, normally those guys block.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that there's a little something to him. I haven't heard too much about buzz that he's generated this week. I think Hunter Long from Boston College has probably made some more plays, at least kind of from, like, the press clippings that I've seen. But, you know, nonetheless, Poljan, just a unique cat. With a crazy story arc, so I'm pulling for him if nothing else, even if, you know, maybe he's not actually like a super viable guy.
His weigh in will be very interesting. I have to believe he isn't that heavy anymore, but if he is, and if you're 6'6", 265, you do not need to run that great. You know, it's like you're huge, and if you're even in the conversation with these other guys, that's pretty impressive, because they're probably about 15 pounds lighter than you.
Could be a Joseph Fourier, maybe. Remember him?
Remember him? Yeah. What was he,
six, a Christian
6'8", 260 or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And he had awesome touchdown dances, if I remember correctly, as well.
That's good. You like to see that. Is this Nick Eubanks, the guy who was at Arizona like 15 years ago? Am I thinking of a different guy?
You might be thinking of a different guy. I'm not entirely sure.
I remember there was a Eubanks who was like an Arizona State quarterback or something. And no, this is a different guy. Okay, so yeah, never mind. I was a little bit intrigued there, because I remember that was a running quarterback. And if he's a tight end, maybe he's a athletic tight end. But no, this class is pretty boring. I guess it's going to – this did Tommy Tremble declare from Notre Dame?
I don't think so.
That's not a Senior Bowl guy. I gotta focus. Anyway, yeah. As far as the Senior Bowl group goes, I would guess we're looking at basically just Yeboah and Poljan, realistically.
Yeah, those two. Oh, and Tremble did declare for the record. I just checked.
Interesting.
That guy. There's a very funny clip of.
I love the name.
Yes, and there's a great clip of someone doing a film breakdown. I think it's Aaron Taylor on Twitter, you know, former NFL guy. He calls Tremble the PR word, which you don't hear that too often in 2020, but he said it in like a in a positive way, just talking about Tremble's blocking and his kind of mentality when he's on the field. And yeah, Tremble, like, he's got some, he's rough around the edges as a pass catcher a little bit, but again, not a Senior Bowl guy, but he's a Notre Dame tight end and he knocks people's block off. Like, there's no question about that. That dude, if you're a defender and you're caught flat footed against him, like, you're going to end up on the ground.
But yeah, it looks like a pretty weak class. The underclassmen are where dynasty drafters will realistically want to focus to even, you know, not necessarily should they specifically strive to do that. But if you must look, I'd kind of keep it limited to Pitts and Freiermuth and maybe Brevin Jordan.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense among those younger guys. Anyone else that you wanted to touch on but before we head out? I know that we kind of notably didn't really talk about any of the quarterbacks, but that there's just not a ton to glean from this work. And we know who, like, the first five or six quarterbacks off the board. Like, none of these guys, Sam Ehlinger, Ian Book, Felipe Franks, like, they're not going to push their way into any real discussion. We had, you know, 15 years of Kellen Mond at Texas A&M.
I'm a little interested in Mond, and I guess even Franks, if he turns out to be athletic, as, like, day three guys. But, yeah,
Franks might have the strongest arm of anyone there, and he's huge. My concern as a Georgia fan who watched him a lot is he's not actually good at football.
See, that's fair. I just think we're heading into a new era, a new paradigm in the NFL where these guys who would have sucked 10, 15 years ago, like Josh Allen, basically, and maybe even Justin Herbert. There's just this thing now where if you tip a threshold of arm strength and, you know, throwing velocity, throwing distance, build and athleticism, you kind of, like, force the defense to spread itself so thin that even bad passers can thrive. But, like, you need to have the arm strength and the athleticism and the build to make the defense spread itself that thin, or else they'll just look like crap. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see how fast those guys turn out to be to kind of get a feel for, like, can they be like that Herbert kind of thing where the defense is so worried about the run and so worried about the deep ball that they can't cover a bad pass to the intermediate. Because I think that's basically the story of Herbert and Allen, is it's like they simply get better conditions in the NFL than they did in college. And maybe a guy like Mond, maybe a guy like Franks can benefit from that sort of thing. I guess it's kind of stupid that we got the big names late last, but Kylan Hill is a running back that you wrote about in the Senior Bowl preview at good length, and he's a round two running back for me. He's very much a conventional 2021 NFL, like, redraft kind of guy that we need to keep an eye on. A little bit less the case for Elijah Mitchell, but I do like him if he tests a certain way. So Marquez Stevenson at receiver, I think, could be right around where Dwayne Eskridge goes. He's definitely a low 4.3 guy. Like, he's skinnier than Eskridge, but he's definitely fast. I don't think Austin Watkins is anything. Shai Smith is just like a swing backup. Kadarius Toney to me is a poor man's Paris Campbell, but we'll see. I could be wrong about that. And let me see real quick. The running backs, Najee Harris had a actually concerning weigh in for me. I was hoping he'd be more like 6'1", 235, like Le'Veon Bell, and he turned out to be more like 6'2", 230. So people aren't going to like to hear. I saw Daniel Jeremiah and then a lot of other people started parroting him, comparing Najee Harris to Matt Forte. It's like, come on, man. I know you're running a query of running backs listed 6'2", and then just, like, picking the one who had the best NFL career.
Don't tell them the secret of how to do this.
Yes. Like, Forte is nothing like Najee Harris. Forte was like 6'1", 217. He ran a 4.44. Matt Forte is more similar to someone like Chuba Hubbard or something. Najee Harris is more objectively similar to Ryan Nall. And he could still be a good running back. He should be way better than Nall and could very well be kind of like the first of his type to be good in the NFL. But those are the terms we're talking about. He is not Matt Forte.
Okay. Yeah. No. I don't think so either. So
ridiculous. Lazy. Lazy. Lazy stuff. Not desperate even.
Yeah. No. I mean. Just generating some buzz, some clicks, with some wild comps. But I think that's going to do it for us here.
Yeah.
For the Senior Bowl breakdown preview extravaganza here on the RotoWire NFL podcast. We, of course, will be back next week. Apparently, there's a big game the following Sunday, so we'll get into that just a little bit. I think the Chiefs and the Buccaneers are playing, so yeah, stay tuned for that one, of course, and then our draft stuff will continue to roll out throughout the course of the off season. So stay tuned for more of that. But for Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening to the RotoWire NFL podcast.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.